but their goal keeps them focused. Back at 1C, the group in command doesn't know what to tell the two officers. They are having trouble keeping contact, and they begin to worry about corrupting the tent scene for the dogs. At one point, they try to tell everyone to pull back to the staging area, where they will reconnoiter and figure out the next step. But by now, the two officers are well on their way. Marty Stage hears the order to return to 1C. He is shocked. "Don't they want to see if the kid's in there?" he asks Kip Duncan. Kip has been a co for less than a year. He is over a decade younger than the seasoned Marty Stage. "Maybe we should wait," he suggests. "Wait for what?" Stage wants to know. "We're not walking all the way back. That's crazy." They have heard the talk about marring what may be a crime scene, but they are officers, for Christ's sake. They have the training to deal with a crime scene, if it comes to that. "Let him jabber," Stage finally says. "We'll be careful, and we'll find out if the kid's in there." Over the next half hour, they make slow progress through three swamps. They are careful to flag their trail, leaving an obvious path for everyone to follow, at least those who can get there. By now, 1C has radio contact with the two officers and approves their actions. Milkovich and Lee, still circling over the spot, cannot see them from the air, even though they're wearing burnt orange coats. It isn't until they are within 170 yards of the tent that Milkovich finally catches a glimpse of the two. Dean Lee swings the plane down over the men, turns it around, and indicates by flight path the trail they should take, such as it is. Other than the occasional drone of the overhead plane and the diminishing radio cackle, the world is eerily still. The rising temperature has filled the air with moisture. It is not fog, but it seems thick, and there is little wind. To Kip Duncan, it looks as though no one has ever passed through this country. It is as though they've entered an ancient burial ground, and the spooky stillness makes them pause. It takes the pair another 10 minutes to close the distance to the tent. By now they are both heated by their effort, heavy with perspiration. When they finally approach the tent through a rise of trees along the western side of the long beaver pond, they aren't thinking about the cold. They are calling out for Jason Rasmussen. They yell his name, but off the surrounding ring of trees their cries echo back unanswered. They push forward. Overhead, Milkovich and Lee keep circling, but there is no radio chatter. The silence around the two coves is intensified by the sudden absence of talk and static. Everyone is holding a breath, waiting for the two men to reach the tent and look inside. The entire area is quiet as a grave, and that's what the two men believe they will find here. Jason Rasmussen's grave. They push up through the last small stand of pines and come out near the top of the rise, yards away from the tent. Both of them stop, examining the surrounding area for anything. Prints, wrappers, a charred ring of stones. The tent is sagging on the rise. There are no tracks in the snow around it. Down in front of it, the slope to the long beaver pond, practically a lake now that they are on the rise above it, is steep and treacherous. But right now the two men focus on the tent opening. The front of it is clear, uncovered in the snow. Beneath the orange overhang, the green tent entrance is closed. "We're at the tent," Kip Duncan radios back to 1C. "Request permission to open it." Back at 1C, Pete Smirid, Pete Walsh, Rebecca Francis, B.J. Kolstedt, Steve Van Kekerix, and the others consider the officer's request. None of them can think of a single reason not to open the tent. They have already warned the officers to be careful about disturbing or contaminating the scene, and they know the Coes are well trained to handle the situation. Finally, the two Petes nod, and BJ gives the okay.
"You have permission to look in the tent," she says. "But don't enter it. Repeat," she says. "Do not enter the tent."
"That's a 10-4, Kip Duncan echoes back. "Open, but do not enter."
The officers are certain that Jason's body lies inside the tent. They smell none of the fetid, cloying odor of death, but then they wouldn't, given the temperatures over the last 8 days, cool as a morgue. Kip Duncan moves forward, carefully stepping over the 10 feet in front of him. He reaches down in the wet air. The sound of the zipper cuts through the late morning air. Kip holds his breath and parts the flap.
There, lying inside the tent, are the neat, well-organized contents of Jason's pack, sleeping mattress, and down bag. Kip looks it over, stunned. His heart is pounding, and he can hear the rush of blood in his ears.
Nothing, he manages to call back to Marty Stage. Nothing but his supplies, he adds.
He hears Marty Stage radio back to 1C. The tent is empty, Stage reports.
Repeat, Jason Rasmussen not found in tent. Over.
Kip looks through the opening. The tent's contents are neat, straight, put away, and laid out as though their owner had a penchant for order. But where in the hell is Jason? And at this point they don't even know if the tent is his. But who else could it belong to? The place is as stale as a burial crypt. The two co's know the routine. Secure the potential crime scene and wait for backup. But at this point they can't see anything that remotely suggests a crime. Still, they zip up the tent and back away from it the same way they approached.
The site is secure, Marty Stage reports. The dogs and Deputy DeRozier's party are on their way,
BJ radios back.
Keep the scene clear and wait for the other teams.
10-4, Stage confirms. The two co's are beginning to feel the effects of their struggle through three swamps, the bogs and the marsh. Now that they're not moving, the cold is starting to settle on them. After several minutes, they decide to move well away from the tent. They hike over 50 yards south-southeast to an area they know the other teams will have to pass in order to get to the tent. Then they build a fire and wait. In the cities, Jason's parents are awaiting for Steve Van Kekerix's call. When it finally comes, Lee answers the phone. He nods into the receiver. Linda senses bad news. There are other cursory comments, but she knows she is not ready to hear the worst. She will never be ready. She feels a dull panic, an anxious mania rising inside her. She doesn't want to know, but she has to listen. She closes her eyes and prays. When Lee signs off, he turns to her.
It's his tent. But Jason's not in it, he repeats.
They don't speak. The days have taken their toll. And now, when they were so close to an answer, confounding it is a calamity they aren't certain they can endure. Later, when Lee is coherent enough to think, he places a call to Jason's sister, Heidi, in Washington, D.C.
I think you'd better come home, he says.
More than 3 hours later, a little after 2 p.m., the co's hear the dog teams and the others approach from the southeast. The teams are happy to come up out of the area to a warm blaze. Deputy DeRozier, Jeff Hossie, Carla and Dale Leahy and their dogs, Jim Couch and his dog Tanner, another air center. They are all wet, tired, and ready to take a break. It is a convivial gathering, though everyone complains about the effort it took to get here. They quickly formulate a plan. The handlers will take the dogs to the tent and see what they can pick up. Then Deputy DeRozier and the co's will examine and catalog the tent's contents. They will begin searching the area in concentric circles, starting close in and widening the distance from the tent as they work their way outward. They are all to keep a sharp eye out for any signs of Jason's passing. By the time the dogs begin working, the skies are beginning to thicken, and the wind starts to rise. The dogs whine over the area. One of them picks up a scent and goes down to the water. The other follows a meandering trail to the northeast. Jim Couch works with Tanner to the south. Inside the tent, DeRozier makes a careful inventory of the contents. Jeff Hossie is behind him, radioing back DeRozier's list. They are struck by what they find. First, the contents are neat and orderly. He didn't leave in a panic. Second, there are no personal items to confirm that this is Jason's tent, though from the parents' recollection of what was packed, there is little question that it is. Third, Jason is an excellent environmentalist. They locate his trash bag, and a quick survey of its contents yields an exact accounting of his meals. They determine he probably left his tent last Wednesday, meaning he has been away from his tent with almost nothing, and apparently no matches, for almost a week. Their last two observations are perhaps their most disconcerting. The parents describe Jason as an expert backpacker, but Jeff Hossie notes several equipment details that contradict that notion. His tent is in okay shape, but it's old and worn. It's a Eureka Timberline, blaze orange, from the late 70s. His backpack is really more of a travel pack, and he has a full-sized bow saw and a stove. Hossie shakes his head at the size and heft of it. Rather than waterproof matches, he's got one of those grill lighters. Rather than a good quality sleeping pad, he has an air mattress. For a backpacking trip, he has lots of clothes. He has clean pants and a couple of shirts folded in his gear. He's carrying 10 times the weight he needs to carry. He may have been experienced, but not in this particular kind of camping. Their quick survey of Jason's equipment suggests that Jason may have known park camping, but not true wilderness. And finally, the book Wilderness Survival, leaning against the side of his pack, has one dog-eared page. Officer DeRozier opens it and starts perusing the section on hypothermia. It makes everyone wonder if Jason may have contemplated suicide. That might explain why he walked off into the woods with no equipment, food, or matches. The dog-eared page is a bad sign. They are careful to document all the contents in the tent, radioing their list back to the staging area. DeRozier and Hossie conclude Jason voluntarily left his camp, and for some unknown reason didn't return. They cannot imagine any good scenarios. When they finally step back from their tent inventory, the dogs are still working the immediate area. At 3:20, Ken Anderson radios Jeff Hossie and tells him there is a bad front moving in. Ken has been monitoring the plane traffic, and Nick Milkovich and Dean Lee corroborate Ken's weather report. They have seen dark clouds building in the north-northwest, clouds that are coming in fast. The weather report from the hangar is bad. A nasty freezing rainstorm is moving in. The plane has to return to Chigawa Lake, and they suggest the searchers contemplate getting back to the staging area. Back beside the fire, the searchers hold a general meeting. The dogs are still searching, but don't seem to be picking up anything definite. They believe, from their animals' behavior, Jason was definitely here, but the dogs don't seem to be identifying a particular direction. One of them repeatedly works the shoreline of the small lake, making some of them suspect Jason is somewhere underwater, anchored in its muddy bottom. As they stand and sit around the fire, one of the searchers, dressed in hunting gear, reaches into his backpack and pulls a sandwich out of a zippered pouch. Jeff Hossie admires the gesture. He surveys the group and notices that everyone here is properly equipped and clothed for the expedition, carrying plenty of survival gear should any one of them get lost in the woods. He cannot ever remember being on a search with a better-equipped and more experienced crowd. But only one or two have brought the proper equipment to spend the night. 1C orders everyone back to the staging area. They will reconnoiter, let the storm pass, and return at first light. Reluctantly, the searchers begin to clear the scene. Everyone, including the dogs, starts back through the bogs and swamps. It's going to be a long haul out. They probably won't reach 1C until well after dark, and from the looks of it, they will be bone cold and covered with rime ice. Less than a half mile away, it has been another tiring long day. Jason has heard the plane overhead to the southeast almost the entire morning and afternoon. Earlier it passed overhead twice, but he was too tired to climb to the top of his stump and wave. From his perch on his log home he simply waved, exhausted, and then blew his whistle. The previous night wasn't good for his feet and legs. The cold settled into his feet and began working its way up his legs. By morning he was numb to his lower calf, and now he doesn't have the energy to get up and move around, working the circulation back into his limbs. He is exhausted. He has one more cup of water, and manages to fill up his bottle with snow, to bring it into his hovel for the night. But he is cold. Throughout the day his shivering rarely abates, and the periodic bone rattling contributes to his misery and fatigue. Jason knows he is freezing. Now and then he hears things in the woods. Ravens appear in the nearby trees, and he tries to speak with them. Later he thinks he hears wolves. He talks to the wolves, tells them how wonderful they are, how much he admires their cunning. Finally, in late afternoon, he turns to complete his letters. Once he finishes with his lists of usernames, passwords, accounts, he starts to let his parents know he loves them and does not want them to suffer. He wants to let them know he has been happy with his life, fulfilled. He writes about how deeply he cares for them, how lucky he has been. He loves them all more than he can possibly convey with a pen and a stretch of bark. The lunacy of writing this on birch bark makes him smile, and then he feels a surge of emotion he cannot contain. He begins weeping in the woods. He is not ready to die. He doesn't know if he's going to awaken. After he crawls into his hollowed-out tree, he is not certain he will have the strength to crawl out. The notion that this may be his final night, at least his last night sitting upright, brings a deep melancholy that weighs on him like a pile of stones. He is surprised he has tears, given his meager intake of water. And then he says out loud, as the dusk light is overcome by clouds, "I love you. I love you all." The wind picks up in the branches. Up on the rise to the west of his tree, he swears he hears the distant strains of Mexican music. It's faint, but reminiscent of the music he sometimes heard in Southern California. He smiles now to recall it. He knows it is impossible that a mariachi band could be playing in the darkening north woods, but he appreciates the minor hallucination. His disposable camera has 24 pictures. He has saved the last one. He wants to wave goodbye, to give his parents and his sister one last glimpse of him on the evening of his last day. Near dusk, with storm clouds moving in fast, he holds the camera at arm's length and positions the lens. He doesn't have the strength to hold the camera long. He summons the best face he can muster. He tries to smile. His large blue eyes try to convey to his family that he's okay. He loves them, and that he will be okay. He is ready to accept whatever comes. He raises his right hand and waves, then snaps the picture. The flash goes off, and he thinks it probably worked. Now, though, he's just too tired to care. For one more night, he crawls into his hollowed-out tree. Jason has never experienced this kind of fatigue. He pulls the branches over his head, sealing the hollow tree opening. Not long after he huddles inside, he hears the rain begin. Throughout the night, the steady rainfall seeps into his shelter, its icy fingers wetting his shoulder, hip, and leg. The cold grip rattles his body with shivers and shakes, though sometime after dark, consciousness lapses into a place where he can no longer feel the cold, where for a brief time he could no longer feel anything. On their way out across the swamps, leaving the tent behind, no one talks about Jason's fate. But Kip Duncan is certain about one thing. There's no way Jason Rasmussen is alive. No one knows what happened to him, but everyone agrees that he is dead. For obvious reasons, they will continue as though it is search and rescue. But now everyone feels the words that no one utters. It is recovery. Recovery of Jason's body. Back at 1C, waiting for the teams to come out of the field, BJ makes a call. She contacts Sarda and requests cadaver dogs. She knows there are several in the state. She's not sure where Jason is, but she suspects he's at the bottom of that lake. Cadaver dogs are trained to scent corpses in wilderness and water. She suspects this one will be found in water. She's already thinking ahead, knowing the recovery could be much faster with as many cadaver dogs in the field as possible. In the cities, Mark Haskins and D.D. Grant, Mary McCormick and Kathy Newman, all trained dog handlers with excellent cadaver dogs, are summoned. They start the journey north, expecting to be at the 1C staging area by first light. Everyone in the field makes it back after dark. They are covered with rhymice. They hike to their ATVs and then ride out of the dark like frozen zombies. They struggle to thaw themselves beside a fire. For Jeff Hossie, cold and numb to his inner core, it is the one last bit of physical evidence he needs to know for certain Jason is no longer alive. No one could survive a night like this one, particularly after 6 days without food or shelter. Rebecca Francis has arranged for everyone to stay in the Isabella Community Center. A local bar and restaurant supplies pizza and drinks. The searchers and dog handlers change into dry clothes. Rebecca hands out garbage bags and instructs everyone to fill them with their soaking clothes. She'll get them dry. Steve Van Kekerix, Pete Smirid, Pete Walsh, B.J. Kolstedt, Jeff Hossie, and Ken Anderson contemplate tomorrow's efforts. After some time, they realize the recovery could involve water, rock climbing, cutting through thick brush, ATVs. The list of possible equipment needs is staggering. Pete Smirid heads off to begin sorting out equipment and placing it in color-coded waterproof bags. Finally, late that night, exhausted, the team finds open spaces on the community center floor to spread their mats and bags. Soon, everyone is asleep. Steve Van Kekerix makes a late-night call to the Rasmussens. He informs them of their progress and their plans for the morning. Lee listens to the undersheriff, thankful for the update. But he hears the tone in Steve's voice. Back at Rebecca Francis's house, the living room is closest to the laundry. She has a good night's work in front of her. In order to get everyone's clothes washed, dried, and sorted, she's going to have to run several loads. She puts in the first batch and retires to her living room couch. At least from here, she thinks, she will be able to hear when the buzzer sounds the end of a wash or dry cycle. She lies down and closes her eyes, hoping for a little shut-eye. Every 20 minutes, her sleep is interrupted by a buzzer. 22. Finding Jason Rasmussen. Northeast of the Powwow Trail, BWCAW. Wednesday, October 31, 2001. Before dawn, the crowd at the Isabella Center has been fed, coffeed, and given fresh, clean clothes. They head back to the 1C communications van, where everyone gathers before first light. Mary McCormick, Mark Haskins, Dee Dee Grant, and Kathy Newman have arrived with their three cadaver dogs. The dogs are all handsome, large German shepherds, striking with their low-slung hips, big heads, and massive chests. Before entering the field, they are fitted with orange canine search and rescue vests. Jeff Hossie will accompany the group with three ATVs and support from Finland Search and Rescue. Earlier in the morning, he had had one of his migraines, and he didn't relish the idea of returning for another nasty slog through those woods. But his migraine finally dissipated, and now he accepts the challenge. 1C is prepared. BJ is incident commander. Pete Smirid is in charge of operations. Steve Van Kekerix is the chief liaison and information officer, and he's also in charge of the purse, should they need another pizza lunch, dinner, or more gasoline. Rebecca Francis is in charge of planning, and Swede Larson manages logistics. Larson is the Silver Bay commander. Unfortunately, he is preparing for a hip replacement, so he hasn't been able to enter the field. But every time the propane is exhausted, the generators die or the volunteers' fire wants wood. Swede is on it. Whatever this day brings, 1C is ready for it. They plan to send one team with dogs in from the south, following yesterday's slog to the tent site, and one up the northern stretch of trail, veering due north on the old portage trail to Lake Insula, turning due east somewhere around Amu Creek, seeing if they can find an easier way in. Deputy Milkovich and Pilot Dean Lee will continue doing flyovers of the area. The team on the trail needs to blaze an ATV trail to the tent. They will need to haul in recovery supplies and to haul out Jason's tent and equipment, as well as to extract their own equipment from the field. And though no one says it, they expect that they will need an ATV with its accompanying pod to haul out his body. Hossie, McCormick, Haskins, Grant, and Newman will work into the site from the north. They get ATV assistance from Finland Search and Rescue support people. These guys are young and expert at clearing trail. They live in this country and know how to wheel through rough terrain. By the time both teams get started, it is 8:40 in the morning. The dogs and people take turns on the ATV and the trailers. The column makes slow progress up the trail. After a 2-mile slog to the circular Powwow Trail juncture, both teams turn northeast, following the Powwow counterclockwise for another couple of miles. At the point where the trail turns 90 degrees due northwest, the southern team continues another mile onto the old Powwow Trail, where they are finally forced to park their vehicles and head into the swamps on foot. From this location, the distance to the tent is about a mile, but the difficult path crosses three swamps, several beaver dams, and some nasty marsh and bog, Those who went yesterday remember the search, and they know it will take at least a couple of hours to find the simplest route through the muck. Hossie and the northbound crew turn northwest on the trail, moving ahead with ATVs almost another 2 miles to the Lake Insula Portage Juncture. Here the powwow trail turns due west, but it is not the clear choice. The 8 members of the northbound team reflect on how easily the Lake Insula Portage could sucker people off the powwow. By comparison, the western powwow trail looks like a narrow game path. The Lake Insula Portage is wide and clear. The rock cairn someone set up to mark the spot is covered over by brush and snow. There is no way for the group to know they are traversing Jason's exact path. They turn north, making slow headway up the portage. About 2 miles to the east, Jason Rasmussen has managed one more climb out of his hollowed-out home. The temperature is moderating. He cannot feel his feet, and his lower legs are numb to mid-calf, but he doesn't have the energy to move around and re-establish circulation and warmth. Instead, his body continues its periodic bouts of shivering. Jason is no longer hungry. He is thirsty, and he manages to trickle down the cup of melted snow from his water bottle. More than satisfying, the brief hydration raises his spirits. But his normal buoyancy is so far diminished now he can only sit and watch the cold forest around him. With his morning draft, something else has entered him. Calm. He sits near his log and feels an unusual stillness, almost an egoless letting go. Yesterday he was sure he heard wolves. They were south of him. But he's been hearing plenty these last few days. He feels as though the woods are playing tricks, more than they've already played on him. Now he is beginning to hallucinate. Not full-fledged hallucinations, but minor alterations in perception. People talking over the hill. The Mexican music. The wolves. He wonders about it all. This much isolation under these kinds of circumstances, where his death seems inevitable, can have a noticeable effect on a mind and the body's ability to perceive. The air is heavy with moisture. It is cold, but already over 40 degrees. The day feels as if it is going to warm, but the wet will keep Jason cold. He continues to shiver. He is tired now. He thinks he will sit outside a while. He feels relatively certain the next time he settles into his shelter he won't be getting up. It is a nice pine log, he thinks. It's a fine coffin, if it comes to that. He feels pretty certain that sometime within the next 2 or 3 days, certainly no more, his body will succumb to its regimen of no calories, little water, unremitting cold and sleeplessness. But for now he feels good about being outside. He likes being in the overcast, misty mid-morning, listening to the trees and brush. He watches them out of eyes sharpened by a sense of impending death. He has stopped thinking, and he lets the world flow in. It is almost as though he is seeing it for the first time. He is haunted by the rhythm of trees. He is mesmerized by the perfect illumination of the muted morning light. And then, as if he hasn't been taunted enough, the plane comes over. In the past it has come close enough for Jason to see the face of the pilot, but it's as though he is invisible. This time he barely rises, stammers to his feet, manages to wave and then raise the whistle to his lips. He blows, but it is an anemic whistle. Still, it is much louder than he could project with his own voice, but he knows he only acts from habit. Something about blowing the whistle after the flyovers is comforting. He doesn't want to give up. Not just yet. Not while he still has the energy to raise the whistle to his lips. He sits down and awaits another flyover, though for what he cannot say. The 8 members of the northern team keep following the trail north over Amu Creek. After a short hike, they come to a place where another trail section turns east. They hike onto it, still able to move through the trees with the ATVs, but not for long. After a half mile, the ATVs can go no farther. The group is heading into heavy terrain, and the trail, while still partially apparent, is impassable, except afoot. Hossie radios their progress at 11:22. The 3 ATV operators are going to hang back and try to clear a wide enough path for the vehicles to reach Jason's tent. Hossie, Haskins, Grant, Newman, and McCormick continue east and then south toward the tent, the cadaver dogs accompanying them. They are to work their way down toward the tent and at some point intersect the crew that just now, if Hasi has heard it correctly via his radio, made it to Jason's last camp. Jim Couch and Carla Leahy are at the tent with their dogs Tanner and Bear. The two dogs begin milling around the tent, trying to pick up scent. The northern group continues east. The trail becomes harder to find through the thick cover. They continue along it, then lose it, then recover it. Near noon they come to a blowdown area. Much of it appears fresh, perhaps from the same storm that dropped all this snow. Some of it is very old, probably from the July 1999 storm. But at 12:35, Jeff Hasi radios out to 1C and the southern group that they have lost the trail. "It's just disappeared," he declares. Hasi knows that if they want to make a relatively straight path to the tent, they will have to do some serious orienteering. His hands are full with the radio. "Who wants to work the compass?" he asks, but there are no takers. The handlers are worried about their dogs. The blowdown area is like a sea of punji sticks, and a careless step on one of the upturned, sharpened points could skewer a paw. They need to keep an eye on their animals. So Hasi continues with the compass, moving very slowly through and over the trees. Mary McCormick and her cadaver dog Ellie move out ahead, then down a rise. Ellie likes to be in front, and Mary has trouble putting brakes on her. To the south, near Jason's tent, Tanner and Bear have picked up a scent and are heading north along the long lakeshore, turning into the woods. Mary McCormick calls out to Ellie, and then hears something. She pauses, leaning into the sound, wanting to be sure she has heard it. Then she turns and looks back at the others, approaching from behind.
"I think I just heard a whistle," she says.
The others stop and listen. No one hears anything. Jeff Hasi radios in to 1C. "We think we heard a whistle," he repeats. He is on the airwaves. It is 1:18. The drone of the plane approaching from the west drowns out all other sounds. D.D. Grant wonders if they are hearing some kind of harmonic resonance from the plane, or a whistle from the southern group moving north. Hasi asks the plane to circle out of the area. He radios to the southern crew and asks them if anyone whistled. The northern group pauses while they wait for a response. "Negative," the answer comes back. "No one's whistled out of our group." The southern group is still moving through the woods, but everyone is together, and they are over a mile from Hasi and the others. D.D. Grant gets on a log and blows hard on her whistle, but there is no response.
"I'm sure I heard a whistle," Mary McCormick reaffirms.
Jeff Hasi radios back to 1C and asks if everyone came in out of the rain yesterday. He wonders if they left someone stranded, and the searcher is in the area. Then Hasi hears the whistle.
"Did anyone hear that?"
McCormick asks.
"That was a whistle," Hasi confirms.
Kathy Newman agrees. D.D. Grant whistles again, but there is no response. Now Hasi is certain they are dealing with a searcher left in the woods. But 1C has double-checked its headcount. They can account for everyone in the woods and back at Forest Center. From their estimation, the only people in the woods are those on the teams that went in this morning. The northern team is confident they have heard something. They decide to work with the dogs. They begin heading south, spreading out in a line through the fallen trees. The plane has been out of the area for over 5 minutes. The crew makes slow progress through the blowdown. Jason thinks he hears a wolf bark to the south. He's unsure, though. Then thinks he hears one from the north. South of Jason, Tanner is angry with Jim Couch, his owner. He is on the trail of something. Over 1,000 yards from Jason, Tanner smells him, and Bear does too. The rescuers are having trouble keeping up. Tanner voices his impatience with a brief series of anxious barks. To the north, the team with cadaver dogs pauses. Ellie gets into some kind of territorial dispute with one of the other dogs. She growls, then barks a warning. Jason is certain it is a wolf. He stands up and listens. Then he calls out through the woods in the direction of the northern rescue team.
"Hi, wolfies," he calls.
It is odd for them to be out in the early afternoon, but he feels good to know he is not alone. He would like to see the wolf pack, but he knows he is not safe in his weakened condition. Then he hears a voice. It's a question.
and he wonders if it's real.
"What's your name?"
comes drifting over the rise.
"Jason Rasmussen,"
he yells. But back at the northern group, all they can hear is a voice. The words are too muffled to be understood. Jeff Hossie still believes it is a lost searcher. No one, not the two groups in the field or the congregation back at 1C, considers that it could be Jason. They gave up on finding Jason alive before last night's deadly ice storm. Today, with their cadaver dogs, their search through the woods is all about recovery, locating and returning with Jason's body. And then they hear a plaintive voice, almost a wail.
"I'm lost!"
somewhere over the hill.
"Hello?"
three members of the group call out.
"Whistle!"
one of them instructs.
"Keep whistling! Who are you?"
they yell. Jason pauses, manages the strength to climb up on his vertical stump, and hears the last question. He is struck by its strangeness. Who in the hell else is lost in these woods?
"Jason!"
he screams back.
"I'm Jason Rasmussen!"
All of the searchers hear it clearly. The entire northern team races through the blowdown, trying to keep up with their dogs. Mark Haskins is the first to come over the rise, following the intermittent blasts of Jason's whistle. He sees Jason on top of the stump, and he is stunned. Jeff Hossie is behind Mark, the others following closely. Hossie cannot believe it. None of them believes it. Hossie's radio is working as he strides forward. They hear Jason's voice at 1:24. It takes 2 minutes to cross through the woods to his location. At 1:26, Jeff Hossie radios back to 1C and to the southern group and the overhead search plane that they have found Jason Rasmussen, alive. Back at 1C, Steve Van Kekerix, BJ, and Pete Smirid ask for clarification. They think they have heard it right, but they are incredulous.
"It's Jason,"
Hossie repeats.
"And he's standing."
The Rasmussen household is all but in mourning. Heidi has returned on an early morning flight. Lee and Linda take her to Lee's mother's house, where they try to eat lunch. For the Rasmussens, it is almost as though Jason's body is in the next room. They believe he is up there somewhere, and he will be found. Lee has learned more about wilderness survival than he ever expected, certainly more than he ever wanted to know. He knows, for instance, that the likelihood of finding Jason alive is virtually nil. No one has ever existed that many days alone in those temperatures and lived to tell the story. No one. They all know. What guides Lee now are the words that have guided him since Jason's failure to return. "Pray for the best," he thinks, "but prepare for the worst." In the beginning, it was easier to lean toward the start of that sentence. Increasingly, he resigns himself to the unimaginable worst. Later, in an aside to Jason's grandmother, Lee talks to her about burying their son in the family plot. The Rasmussen's cupboards are as barren as a January field. The search for Jason has been going on for almost a week. During that time, their lives have been everything but routine. Now the refrigerator contains condiments and stale cheese. Heidi is home now, and they know they will have to stop and buy something to replenish their supplies. They have no appetites, but they know they must continue, move forward. Maybe buying groceries will at least give them something else to think about. There is a Costco near their house. On the way home from Grandma's, they swing by the Costco to pick up a few items. For the brief few seasons Steve Van Kekerix has been Lake County Under-Sheriff, he has had to make some difficult calls. Usually it is over traffic accidents. It's about the worst part of his job. When Jeff Hossie's radio call comes in to 1C, Van Kekerix is standing with BJ, Pete Smirid, Rebecca Francis, Swede Larson, and the others. Everyone in 1C, everyone on the search, everyone in the field, assumed the cadaver dogs would be the ones to find Jason, not their handlers. The news that Jason is alive, that he is standing, that he appears to be, at least from the first frenetic accounts flooding into 1C, in remarkable shape, is incomprehensible. No one has ever survived this long in the forest without food, water, or shelter. And at this point they know nothing about Jason's remarkable story, how he kept himself alive. For 6 days, Steve Van Kekerix has been the county official in charge of the search and rescue. Everyone turned to him for permission and assistance, and he was the primary voice between the search area and the family. He kept the Rasmussens informed, being honest without sharing all the negative perspectives. But he pulled no punches. He let the Rasmussens know, and they were grateful. Lee, Linda, and Heidi, standing near their car in the Costco parking lot, don't want to answer the call coming into Lee's cell phone. He can see from the display it's Van Kekerik's. It is 1:35 p.m., and he knows the searchers have been in the field all morning with dogs. He knows the call. He wasn't expecting it so soon. But he thinks he knows the words he is going to hear. For a brief moment, he considers not answering. After flipping open his phone, about all he can manage is a hoarse,
"Hello?"
The wind is out of his diaphragm. He feels lightheaded, not entirely present. He hears the familiar voice.
"Jason's found," Van Kekerik yells. "He's alive! He's well!"
There are no words for how news of Jason's survival and condition, after so long alone in the woods, in the heart of one large tree, after so many people have been searching for him for so long, is heard by Jason's parents and his sister. This is one of the times in people's lives when prayers are answered, resoundingly and with undiminished affirmation. In the brief time it takes to speed home, Lee, Linda, and Heidi rock the inside of their car with the remarkable news.
"He's found!" they repeat, screaming it. "He's alive! He's well!"
They spend less than 5 minutes tossing clothes into bags. On their way out of town, heading north, they give Jason's grandmother the good news and ask her to spread the word. They know there is no better emissary for conveying rapid news to the wide family network and the wider world than Jason's grandmother. Van Kekerik has told them it will probably be at least 2 hours before Jason is out of the woods. Then he'll be taken to some local hospital to be examined. The Rasmussens will find out where on their way north. Jason was discovered at 1:26. Less than 10 minutes later, Van Kekerik phoned the Rasmussens with the miraculous news. But it takes a team of searchers, ATV drivers, trail makers, and communications people another 3.5 hours to get him out of the woods. During the long wait, a crowd containing almost everyone who participated in the search begins to form. Yesterday, Kip Duncan, the co who first opened Jason's tent to discover it vacant, was happy he had worked the next day in Two Harbors. He felt certain Jason could never be found alive. His work in Two Harbors was preferable to searching for Jason's body in these difficult woods. Now, on his radio, he picks up the incredible news. In less than an hour, he pulls into the 1C. Joe Linneman, the deputy who verified the presence of Jason's car 6 long nights ago, is back on duty after several days off. On special occasions, Joe plays bagpipes. Today he tosses them into his truck and heads down to the trailhead. Over 50 people and an ambulance wait in the trailhead lot. When Jason comes out of the woods, a cry goes up unlike anything he has ever heard. They take him to Miller Dewan Medical Center in Duluth, where he will be treated for severe frostbite, and where he is finally reunited with his parents and sister, and where he can finally give each of them the birch bark letters he wrote during the darkest days of his life. Epilogue. Jason Rasmussen lost 2 toes and the tips of all the others to frostbite, and spent a long convalescence at his parents' house, during which he briefly endured a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. He was featured in several news stories and local news programs, and even on National Geographic's This Week, Corbin Burnson's Wild Survival, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. When Winfrey asked Jason if the experience changed the way he lived or experienced life, he replied, "Sometimes I will be walking down the street and the wind will blow through the trees, and I'm overcome by the beauty of that moment. And also there's a feeling of real peace. I don't know what that is, but I've never felt it before. And it's great." Several media outlets tried to obtain exclusive rights to Jason's story, but he refused, considering his misadventure an opportunity to instruct so that others might avoid the pain of his ordeal. When he was well enough, he presented the details of his survival at REI and elsewhere. His parents thanked Minnesota's volunteer search and rescue community by hosting a weekend conference, at which many of the state's volunteer groups shared strategies for coordinating future rescue efforts. Jason Rasmussen returned to medical school after the first of the year. Today, he is an emergency room surgeon in residence in Sacramento, California, where he continues to repay the altruism of Minnesota's volunteers by saving others' lives. Dan Stevens had a chance to see the group from Chattanooga before they returned home. He assured them they had done the right thing and congratulated them on their one-day sprint across the lakes. Soon afterwards, he returned home to Georgia, cutting his guiding season short. His parents had local doctors examine his lacerated legs. They removed the bandages and were shocked at his condition. Fortunately, with further treatment, his legs and his eye healed. He became an expert at creating fire without matches, demonstrating and teaching the technique to scouts and others interested in wilderness survival. When he was finding his way through wilderness, Stevens could tell that he had a phenomenally heightened awareness and a deep internal focus. It was the highest degree of concentration in my life. I was in this zone that I don't think I'll ever be in again. I had a lot more capacity than I expected. After being ferried across the water by the New Jersey Scouts, he says, I wasn't the same person. That's when I felt the pain. The experience also made him reevaluate his perspective on life. All of this is temporary, he says, describing his everyday encounters with family, friends, and other experiences. We really should take advantage of it. Today, Dan Stevens is a hydrologic technician with the U.S. Geological Survey in Atlanta, Georgia. He still loves to spend time in the wild, for pleasure and for work. This concludes Lost in the Wild by Carrie J. Griffith. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Copyright 2006 by Carrie J. Griffith. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Minnesota Historical Society and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.